Today is Thursday, January 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. As the U.S.-Russia talks over European security move to Vienna, EU officials say Europe should be at the table.
It's not just U.S. and Russia. If we want to talk about security in Europe, the Europeans have to be part of the table.
With the coronavirus Omicron variant surging, many Americans are turning to home tests, but are they reliable?
The process itself was pretty easy, but I wasn't confident about what the results said.
And China orders more lockdowns just weeks before hosting the Winter Olympics. We'll have these stories and more next. Talks between Western nations and Russia to de-escalate tensions over the Russian troop buildup along the Ukraine border have moved to Vienna. Talks over the security of Europe have been held in Geneva this past week, but the European Union was not present, and bloc officials have voiced growing frustration. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Russia has massed over 100,000 troops close to the border with Ukraine. Meanwhile, Moscow complains of a NATO military build-up in Eastern Europe and has warned of the dangers of confrontation. With tensions building, Washington and Moscow met for talks in Geneva this week, but the European Union was excluded to its clear frustration. Josep Borrell is the European Union High Representative for Foreign Affairs.
On this dialogue, there are not two actors alone. It's not just U.S. and Russia. If we want to talk about security in Europe, the Europeans have to be part of the table.
But the EU is late to that table, says analyst Liana Fix, a resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund in Washington, D.C.
The problem here is that the European Union has not been involved formally in talks in 2014 when the Ukraine crisis started. Back then we had Germany and France in the Normandy format and no official EU representative. Within the European Union, the question is who is more powerful, the member states or the EU as an institution itself. And on the other hand, in Moscow, the EU is not taken seriously.
France is leading a European push for what it calls greater strategic sovereignty, driven by concerns over America's commitment to NATO. Paris says Russia's President Vladimir Putin is deliberately trying to bypass the EU. Jean-Yves Le Drian is the French foreign minister.
He has no consideration for the European Union, and he is totally determined to try to put dents in European unity, which is solidifying.
Moscow also aims to undermine the transatlantic alliance, argues analyst Petro Berkovsky, a senior fellow at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation in Kiev.
Russia uses these talks in order to destroy trust between the United States and European partners, and tries to demonstrate that the United States are ready to discuss its security in Europe and discuss its policy in Europe behind the European partners.
Without its own military force, the European Union as an institution may not be taken seriously by Moscow, but it does have a key role to play, says analyst Liana Fix.
When the European Union and the United States now think about economic sanctions towards Russia in case of an intervention, of an invasion of Ukraine, then it is the European Union that will have to deliver an economic sanctions package and has to deliver the agreement of all member states.
Meanwhile, following talks between NATO and Russian officials Wednesday, the United States said transatlantic allies were united. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman led the U.S. delegation.
I think one of the things that Russia has done, which it probably did not expect, it has brought all of Europe, NATO and non-NATO allies alike, together to share the same set of principles, the same ambition, the same hopes, and the same commitment to diplomacy.
21 European Union member states are also members of NATO. And despite the frustration, analysts say the EU recognizes that the alliance remains the bedrock of its own security. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Russian Ambassador Alexander Lukashevich said Russia laid out its set of security proposals at Thursday's meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in Vienna, but did not receive a satisfactory response. Norway holds the rotating presidency of the Security Council in January. Mona Juul, Norway's ambassador to the United Nations, says Norway has decided to elevate the debate on the Middle East situation to a ministerial level on January 19th. Norway's government says the Israeli-Palestinian conflict deserves more attention 30 years after the Madrid Peace Conference. Juul said it is critical to enhance the UNSC's focus on the need to find a political solution to this protracted conflict and make sure there are no actions that undermine the prospects of a two-state solution. Reporter Angie Omar spoke with Ori Neer with the organization Americans for Peace Now about the development.
Well, first of all, I'll say I agree with Norway, and I think its approach is correct. Whether it will revive the peace process, probably not. But at the very least, which I think is still an important thing, it could revive the international interest in Israeli-Palestinian peace and in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And I hope that at the very least, it will cause the Biden administration to rethink its attitude, its policy of benign neglect regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and efforts to resolve it. You know, Norway has played a very important role in the beginning of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations, the process that's known as the Oslo process, and still has quite a bit of leadership, I would say, in this realm of Israeli-Palestinian relations. However, on the international arena, there's only one effective leader, only one player that can really push and play the role of a broker between the parties, between Israelis and Palestinians, and that's the United States. And unfortunately, it seems like the Biden administration at the moment is not interested in playing that role of a broker.
The U.S. administration announced that it is examining the possibility of reopening the offices of the Palestine Liberation Organization, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas resumed security cooperation with Israel. Would such moves pave the way for resuming some sort of negotiations?
Such moves would pave the way to greater trust. I don't think that they will pave the way to negotiations per se. That still seems pretty far on the horizon. But it's still important to rebuild the trust between the Palestinians and the United States, between Israel and the Palestinians. There are three main players when it comes to Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations and the future of peace between them. And that's obviously Israel, the Israeli government, the Palestinian government or the PLO, and the United States. And so if the U.S. is taking measures to rebuild trust with the Palestinians, if the Palestinians are taking measures to rebuild trust with the Israelis and vice versa, you have a more solid infrastructure or foundation over which you can rebuild the negotiations, the peace process in the future. At the moment, it doesn't seem like it's in the card, but in the future, I think it will be.
That was journalist Angie Omar in Cairo speaking with Ori Neer, who is with Americans for Peace Now, which works to build peace between Israel and Palestinians. China is fighting coronavirus outbreaks in several cities just weeks before hosting the Beijing Winter Olympics. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has this report.
The Chinese government is enforcing a zero-tolerance COVID-19 policy to stop neighboring outbreaks disrupting the Beijing Winter Olympics. Across China, more than 20 million people are in some form of lockdown, with many prevented from leaving their homes. The city of Tianjin, which is an hour from Beijing, is on high alert. Although not in full lockdown, the city has cancelled almost all flights, suspended high-speed train services and closed highways. Nevertheless, despite an unabating global pandemic and a US-led diplomatic boycott, organizers are determined that the games will go on. I'm Karen Chamas.
U.S. President Joe Biden is redoubling his administration's efforts on COVID-19 testing amid shortages of test kits. At a news conference on Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki outlined some of the actions the Biden administration has taken to respond to the Omicron variant surge and defended the government's response.
At every step in this process, and frequently, the president provides updates on how we're building on our capacity, right? Whether that is vaccine distribution or capacity at one point, testing capacity or supplies, PPE. So he will be building on that.
Psaki says the administration has deployed more than 2,100 federal personnel across the country to fight the pandemic. With Omicron infections about to reach their peak in the U.S., demand for COVID-19 tests has soared. But questions linger about the accuracy of certain tests. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias explains.
Jordan Irby and his partner Julia Weil visit COVID-19 testing sites often.
We get tested so that we can see our friends without being concerned that we're spreading COVID.
They'd rather have someone who's trained take samples for a lab instead of relying on at-home tests. The Wild has used self-tests before visiting elderly relatives.
The process itself was pretty easy, but I wasn't confident about what the results said.
Her instinct was right. In 2020, researchers found that in people with COVID symptoms, the antigen tests were less accurate than the PCR tests, which can take a lab 48 hours to process. Alexandra Bryson is the Associate Director of Clinical Microbiology at the Virginia Commonwealth University Health System.
We directly compared the Binax Now antigen test to the gold standard PCR test. The antigen test missed detecting 20% of all COVID-19 cases.
There's no conclusive data yet on how well rapid antigen tests work on the Omicron variant. But people can take steps to be more confident in the results. As is, they catch about 4 in 5 positive cases. Testing too early in the infection is discouraged, says Dr. Robert Bollinger, a professor of infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
If you're testing while you're symptomatic and you have a bad cold symptoms and you have a lot of virus in your system, you're more likely to be accurate in that situation. We do often recommend multiple rapid tests. So not just one test, but you do your antigen test today, maybe test it again in 24 or 36 hours.
Dr. Peter Chen Hung, a professor of medicine in California, says pay close attention to the swabbing technique when testing at home.
Depending on the platform, you swab at least 5 to 10 times on each side, and then you put it in the reagent, and then you just basically have to time it. Not look too soon because it may be falsely negative, and not look too late because they may be unstable chemicals.
President Joe Biden's administration has promised 500 million COVID test kits for American households soon. And local governments are rushing to open new testing sites. They encourage patients to report positives to their healthcare providers. But they also emphasize testing is only one part of the answer to containing the virus. Hannah Winant is the spokeswoman of the Arlington County Department of Public Safety, Communications, and Emergency Management.
We still caution our residents and people around the world to follow steps to prevent the spread of COVID-19, regardless of whether or not they have a negative test. And that's maintaining social distancing, wearing a mask when indoors with people outside of your immediate household, and most importantly, to get vaccinated.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
You're listening to VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. U.S. President Joe Biden is making a forceful pitch for passage of voting rights legislation that he and many others see as crucial to the integrity of U.S. democracy. This is Republican-controlled legislatures are passing laws restricting access to the ballot. We will discuss this and many more obstacles on the U.S. Politics edition of Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
U.S. President Biden meets privately on Thursday with Senate Democrats to come up with a strategy for passage of their voting and elections legislation. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has the story.
In a memo obtained by the AP, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer outlines a plan to hold debate that could stretch for days on voting rights legislation. His proposal comes as Democrats seek ways to actually pass the measures because of the 50-50 split in the Senate. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says President Biden is ready for the fight.
This is a defining moment that will divide everything before and everything after, when the most fundamental American right that all others flow from, the right to vote and have your vote counted, is at risk.
The lengthy debate would still not solve the fundamental problem. Democrats lack any Republican support, as well as the backing of Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona for a rules change to allow passage by a simple majority. Tim McGuire, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Damme. French teachers across the country staged a walkout on Thursday to express their anger over the way the government is handling the coronavirus pandemic in schools. Teachers denounced confusing rules and have called for more protection. A majority of teachers are expected to support the call by 11 unions to protest virus-linked class disruptions and changing isolation rules. France has some of the highest COVID numbers in Europe, with new daily infections topping 360,000 in recent days. A German court Thursday sentenced a former intelligence officer in Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's security services to life in prison after convicting him of crimes against humanity in a landmark trial. The man, identified in court as Anwar R., had been charged with 58 murders, rape, and sexual assaults at a prison facility in Damascus, managed by an intelligence unit that he headed. He has denied all charges. The United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said the sentence was a landmark leap toward justice for victims of abuses in Syria. It's still unclear whether tennis champion Novak Djokovic will be able to play in the Australian Open. The government has not announced whether it will deport him for being unvaccinated for COVID-19. The tennis star is slated to play in the opening round next week, but the immigration minister still might deport him, even after Djokovic won a legal battle last week over having his visa canceled. Kazakh authorities have arrested more than 12,000 people during nearly 2 weeks of riots and deadly anti-government protests. 164 people were killed in the violence. In part two of our conversation, former U.S. Ambassador to Kazakhstan George Kroll tells me the Kazakh people have been seeking economic reforms for years.
Human rights defenders are wondering, you know, is this simply another turn of the screw, or is this really serious? And I guess it's now up to the President Tokayev with his new group. Is there going to be a real rearrangement of the wealth and power relationships in Kazakhstan? And is it really going to change where it will be more, it will listen and not only listen, but do things that may assuage people's concerns that they're not being listened and their needs are not being taken care of?
You mentioned before that Kazakhstan is a huge country. Talk about where it is strategically located and why is Kazakhstan important?
It is the ninth largest country in the world. It has a 9,000-kilometer border with the Russian Federation, with Siberia and the like, and it has 20% of its population is ethnically not ethnic Kazakh, mostly Russian, living along that northern border. They also have a very long international border with Western China, you know, Xinjiang province, where the Uyghurs are. It also is one of the biggest oil producers in the world, and international energy firms like Chevron and ExxonMobil and in consortia. And so it's very important for numerous actors.
Is it your feeling that the government will look at this seriously and say, was this bad that we have to be serious about undertaking reforms?
That is what President Tokayev said in his speech to the parliament. This is the time for a new Kazakhstan, and called on the parliament to approve his prime minister, which they did, Mr. Samoilov, that this is the time for building a new Kazakhstan. Now, what we will see after this will be important. What steps will they take that will not be cosmetic, but will actually be addressing the social and economic grievances that he has acknowledged people do have?
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think is important to point out, Kazakhstan, the country, and its people, in view of what's just happened there?
I think that what we're seeing 30 years after independence, you know, Kazakhstan built a system largely under the leadership of Nursultan Nazarbayev. And over time, that leadership and its policies, the like, have ossified in a certain respect. And you have now a population that is different, a newer generation, even a more national generation, more Kazakh. I mean, the Kazakhstan, when it first became independent 30 years ago, was only half ethnic Kazakh. Now it's 80%. And there is a certain sense of nationalism, but also of a generation of people that, while they may have suffered, the older generation had seen the dislocation and the like of the economically and so forth at the end of the Soviet Union. The newer generation is looking to a government and saying, look, what about us? We're a wealthy country. Why don't we feel wealthy and the like?
That was former U.S. Ambassador to Kazakhstan, George Kroll. He was speaking to me from his home in Newport, Rhode Island. China's expanding influence and economic reach in Europe is met with a mixture of praise and complaints in the Greek port of Piraeus. Athens reporter Laurent Laughlin has the details.
Since the Chinese company COSCO took over management of Piraeus, Greece's biggest port, the tonnage handled by the port's container terminal has quintupled and jobs are being created. But some workers say they are not seeing the benefits. Greek shipowner Nicolas Vernikos is one of the happy ones. He says what's happening here is good for business.
The investment that was made by the Chinese company COSCO in the managing company of the Piraeus port is very positive for Greece.
But Konstantinos Spiropoulos, vice chairman of a union at the port, says most of the new investment has gone into the container sector, leaving the ship repair sector where he works behind. Among his frustrations in his sector, 200 men have to share a single toilet.
So all the guys working in this ship as a crew and as repairmen, they all have to deal with this toilet and clean their hands in the COVID years.
Chinese shipping company COSCO now owns 67% of the port. In 2016, the Chinese ambassador to Greece said Piraeus was a key link of the Belt and Road Initiative. He also spoke of Greece's potential to become a transportation hub in this part of the Mediterranean. Under a contract signed that year, COSCO committed to purchasing a 51% stake in the port immediately and another 16% after 5 years. It also pledged to invest 294 million euros in the port, but the pledge was not fulfilled within the five-year period, says Vasilis Kanakakis, president of a shipyard union.
Instead of imposing the penalty, we granted them the additional 16% and an extension of 5 years for implementation. This is catastrophic because if this place stays like this for 10 more years, none of us will be here.
Derek Scissors, American Enterprise Institute China economy expert.
That's one of the issues with becoming dependent on China. I think China has helped Greece with the improvement of Piraeus. But if you become unhappy with the Chinese presence for whatever reason, you're now stuck because who else is going to come in and take over that port the way that, you know, and operate it the way the Chinese have? Nobody.
COSCO did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Vernikos, who is also president of the International Chamber of Commerce, says the Chinese presence benefits his country, especially considering Greece's recent emergence from a decade-long financial crisis. Again, Greek shipowner Nicolas Vernikos.
Piraeus is developing, or in fact is the fastest growing port of the world. More and more cargo ships visit Piraeus.
The Piraeus Port Authority chairman, Yu Zhengang, says thousands of jobs will be created to support the port and the community around it. But Kanakakis questions the quality of the jobs at the port.
Temporary and low-wage positions have been created.
While some port workers worry about wages and working conditions, others at the port are banking on the business that its Chinese owners will bring. Laurent Laughlin for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
That's it for today. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thanks so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.